time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Jen Marlowe and Nada Alwadi. Jen Marlowe is an author, documentary filmmaker, playwright, and human rights social justice activist. She is co-author of the books I Am Troy Davis and The Hour of Sunlight, and author of Darfur Diaries, which is also the title of a documentary film she produced of the same name. She is director and producer of the new documentary Witness Bahrain, which premiered this week at the Seattle Transmedia Independent Film Festival, which we'll be talking about. Nada Alwadi is a Bahraini journalist who was a reporter for Al-Wasat, Bahrain's most popular daily newspaper, where she covered the pro-democracy uprising in that country. She is also co-founder of the Bahraini Press Association, which seeks to protect Bahraini journalists from repression, and she is also co-producer of the documentary Witness Bahrain. Jen and Nada, thank you very much for both coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having us. Thanks, Mike.
So start out, Nada, if you would give us some history about the pro-democracy movement that from, I think most Americans perceive that it started in 2011. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The demand for the demand for democracy in Bahrain didn't start in 2011. It's kind of a historic demand since our independence in 1971 from the British colony. Every 10 years, we will hear all these popular uprisings or demands or protests by the population demanding that more role of the population in terms of governing the country. Bahrain is kind of an absolute monarchy where one family literally owns and controls everything. And that system have always felt outdated for the population. This is why the demands for democracy dates back even to the 20s or the 50s. There were popular uprisings back then for Bahrainis to demand share in the political decision making process. In 2002, the new king came into power, promising a new reform. With new legislations, we for the first time we actually had a parliament where there were members in the parliament. People actually can vote for these members. After 10 years of practicing on that new system, I'm talking about 2010, everybody was it was very clear that this practice was not actually working, even though we had all these legislations and the bodies, parliament body, they can't really, people can't really make any decision within that particular system. The authorities are still in the hands of the king, who can dissolve the parliament anytime. Besides many other issues, obviously discrimination and the share of power and the rule of law, I would say that all these issues somehow led to what happened in 2011. I'm sure many of your audience know or remember the popular Arab Spring uprisings, which happened in 2011, swept through the whole Middle East. Even though I don't like that term, Arab Spring, but anyways, we don't have any other terminology yet for that. But anyways, Bahrain was part of that. It was so inspiring to see all these young people in Egypt, for example, in Tahrir Square, protesting and demanding change and democracy. That was so inspiring to so many people. And I was actually in Bahrain, and I remember vividly people being glued to TV watching Egypt and actually going out and protesting to support the Egyptian people. So it was not surprising, actually, to see a few weeks later that people organized themselves and said, you know what, we are going to do an Egyptian style revolution, where they decided to protest in the middle of the capital, Manama, in a place called the Pearl Roundabout, which doesn't exist anymore. A month later, there was a major crackdown on those protesters. The Pearl Monument was demolished. Since then, actually, it was in April 2011 until now, the country has been in a major political crisis. opposition leaders have been in jail since then. So many Bahrainis have been tortured, jailed, oppressed upon, fired from their jobs. Many of them had to leave their countries, their country, because of this crisis. And unfortunately, until now, we don't see any solution, political solution in the horizon.
In fact, you had to leave your country. Can you talk briefly about that?
Sure. That's actually very true. So I am a journalist. I worked for Al Wasat newspaper, which is one of the most popular newspapers in Bahrain. And I also was a correspondent for USA Today in Bahrain, covering the story from the ground. And when the crackdown started, they started targeting everybody who kind of took part in that movement, including doctors, professors, students, and obviously at the top of the list are journalists. So I was personally detained and, well, was told not to report. I was actually forced to sign a pledge not to report or engage in any political affair. And I really didn't feel safe afterwards. It was very hard to do anything. To do my job, basically, which is journalism. I'm not an activist or an opposition figure. I'm just a journalist who was trying to do my job, interviewing people and telling their story. So I decided to leave. I have been here in the States. I'm based in D.C. for the past 4 years. And I was hoping that things will get better and I will go back, but things were actually getting worse. And I'm not an exception. I mean, there are so many of my colleagues, journalists, who actually had to leave the country for similar reasons. I mean, freedom of expression is kind of a myth now in Bahrain. It doesn't really exist because local journalists have been targeted in almost every single way. And international journalists are not given permissions to enter or visas to enter the country to report from the ground. So basically, there is a media blackout. The story doesn't really get covered. So people don't really know that this is still going on. I can still say that there are so many people who keep telling me, oh, is this still going on? I mean, we thought that this is over by now, Bahrain, but it is pretty much still going on. And I think Jin's film shows or portrays a lot of it and shows that this pretty much is alive. The struggle for these people is still alive.
And Jin, how did you get involved in this issue?
I got involved in Bahrain in early 2012. There was a group of colleagues, friends of mine, who were putting together a team to enter Bahrain for the one-year anniversary of the uprising. So the uprising, like Neda said, it had a long history, but February 14th, 2011 was when the large protests first started. At the one-year anniversary of that, activists in Bahrain wanted to organize big demonstrations. They actually were hoping to retake the place where Pearl Roundabout once stood, which had since been demolished by the regime since it had become a symbol of the revolution. And so friends of mine who were some among the founders of the International Solidarity Movement in Palestine and who were some of the Bahraini activists started really brainstorming with the Bahraini activists about putting together a team of international solidarity activists who would go in ahead of those demonstrations and be able to both witness what happened and also perhaps be a protective element, because the expectation was that these marches could lead in a real bloodbath. And if there were internationals there, that might and the regime knew that might encourage them to use a little less force. And so I was actually invited to be a part of that initial team. I wasn't able to go at that time because I was in the midst of writing the manuscript for I Am Troy Davis, which was, I think, the last time I was speaking with you here in the studio when that book came out. But from that moment on, I started paying very close attention to what was happening to Bahrain. And I was already paying close attention to the so-called Arab Spring, and knew I wanted to be able to find some way to express support and solidarity to activists in the Middle East who were struggling for their basic human rights and for their freedom. And so that group of activists went in. They all got into the country and they all got deported within days. I think one of them managed to hang on for a week before she was deported, but they were most of them caught and deported within 3 or 4 days. But then a few months later, when I finished the first draft of the manuscript of my book that I was working on, and I had a little bit of time at that point, I reached out to the activists in Bahrain and said, you know, is this still helpful to you to have international presence? And they said, yeah, definitely. Why don't you come? So I ended up going in June 2012, several months after that first group, but under the same premises as a solidarity activist to witness, to support. And I'm really glad that I ended up going not with that initial group because I was planning to stay for 3 weeks. I was deported at the end, but after I had stayed the full 3 weeks, I was deported when I was leaving. They caught me at passport control. So I was able to stay for the whole time. I didn't intend to make a film. That was not my intention in going. That just kind of happened while I was there. One of the activists knew I was a filmmaker and gave me a camera. And I thought I'd be writing some blog posts about what I witnessed. I thought, okay, maybe I'll film some short interviews and put some things up on YouTube. But, you know, after several days of being there, I realized that there were really powerful stories that deserved more attention than just a clip on YouTube. And sort of in the middle of it, all of a sudden, I realized I was making a film without ever having planned to do that.
There are several people in your film that are the focus, one of whom we won't mention by name. But can you talk about, let's talk about the woman that features mm-hmm. primarily in the film.
So the woman who is primarily featured in the film, she, a phenomenal woman, she had been an investment banker and a pro-government supporter. And when she really, in 2011, when she really witnessed the bloodshed that the Bahraini regime, and she witnessed the crackdown that the Bahraini regime was perpetrating, she did a 180. I mean, she hadn't wanted to believe that that was happening. She hadn't wanted to see it, but she went to the Pearl Roundabout, saw with her own eyes, and that pushed her into doing human rights work. She had never been an activist before. She had never considered herself to have anything to do with the field of human rights, but she saw with her own eyes what was happening to her people, and she felt that she couldn't stay silent. So she contacted the Bahrain Center for Human Rights, and she said, I want to help however I can. By the time I met her, she was a fully committed activist, and she was spending all her time trying to do a lot of what she was doing was the documentation of the stories of the doctors who had been detained and tortured. That story, of course, is in the film. Doctors who had been detained and tortured because they had treated injured protesters at the Pearl Roundabout and at the hospital and at the main hospital, Salmani Hospital. So that had been one of her areas of deepest involvement. But when I met her, I actually ended up staying in her home for most of the time that I was in Bahrain. And we ended up traveling around the country together. And that in many ways became the film. It was following this young woman as she was taking me around and as she was, she was the one conducting the interviews. She was the one doing all the speaking with people. And I was just basically standing behind her with the camera, and she's an extraordinary, courageous human being.
And Bahrain, of similar to the U.S., but a bit more active, uses surveillance heavily, electronic surveillance, so that it came out in the film that she couldn't really meaningfully ask specific information over the phone, knowing that that would be listened to and tracked.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The surveillance is really acute in Bahrain, and none of the Bahraini activists would use their cell phones for sensitive information. There was very, very creative ways that people had of trying to get each other information, and everybody would use other, harder to monitor, harder to crack forms of communication. But everyone knew that their cell phones were being tapped and listened mm-hmm. to and monitored. And mm-hmm. and yeah, people were always very aware of what to say. So, for example, when the young woman that we were talking about would be talking about me to another activist, if they had to make a phone call, she would never say, what time do you want to meet Jen? She would say, that young woman who was at your house yesterday, what time do you want to meet her? And for her, it was just second nature to know what to say and what not to say so that things would be detected or not detected. I mean, the activists on the ground were experts at how to navigate the surveillance systems in order to still communicate the way they needed to?
Actually, in 2013, Reporters Without Borders added Bahrain as one of the top 10 countries that they called it enemies of the internet, which is basically for mainly for the surveillance that you mentioned now, which is actually quite interesting. There were several initiatives who studied that in particular, that particular aspect of monitoring and how the system of monitoring activists. One of them is actually called Bahrain Watch. This is a group of international activists who are quite savvy in terms of technology. And they actually analyzed many of the links that have been sent via email to several activists, Bahraini activists, and proved scientifically that these links contains malware. Many of these activists, by just clicking on that particular link, there will be an installation of a malware in their devices, and they will be tracked. Everything in their computers or devices will be tracked. There were also several cases of IP hacking. So they will actually also send links around, like to activists who are very quite active in social media, for Twitter or Facebook. And just by clicking on that link, maybe by mistake, you install a device that they will know where your location is. And in some cases, there were people who were, in few hours after kind of clicking on that particular link, the police were at their door in their houses, and they were arrested and jailed. So it's interesting, because that particular initiative found out that the software that the government is using is done by a German company, Gamma, and they contacted them and said that you are selling this surveillance software to governments to spy on activists, and they denied it publicly. But it was proven in several cases that this is actually the software. I mean, in many cases, the software that is used by governments in around the world, in the Middle East in particular, is done by countries in the West, and it's sold by big companies to these governments to spy on their citizens. So yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, it's kind of very hard. Everybody knows that, you know, now that we have a political crisis, that nothing is safe online. If you tweet, if you share information, if you are well-known, you will be monitored.
In fact, tweets are what got one of the people featured in your film, Jen, thrown into prison. Can you talk about that?
Correct. Yeah. Nabil Rajab is one of the activists that the film features. And Nabil is, I would call him one of the most prominent human rights defenders in Bahrain and actually in the Arab world. He's the co-founder and the president of the Bahrain Center for Human Rights. And when I was in Bahrain, he had when I first arrived in Bahrain, he was in prison because of messages that he sent out on Twitter that the regime found insulting. And it's illegal in Bahrain, by the way, to insult the king and by association to insult the regime. So anything that they decide is insulting, which could be any tweet that indicates criticism, any tweet that indicates opposition. That is actually officially criminalized in Bahrain. So Nabil was in prison when I arrived. He got out of prison shortly after I arrived in Bahrain. And so I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time with him and hear about his philosophy and his struggle for human rights, for democracy, and his support for Bahrainis rising up nonviolently to challenge the oppression and that they were facing. And Nabil was very clear in his emphasis of support for nonviolent struggle and for peaceful struggle, which is really a hallmark of the Bahraini revolution. And while I was in Bahrain, we got notice that there were still several cases pending against Nabil. And one of those cases, a verdict and a sentence had been handing down, and Nabil was sentenced to 3 months in prison, again, for another tweet that he sent out. And so when when I learned this, we rushed right over to Nabil's house, knowing that the police would be coming sometime that morning to take him away to prison. And so I had the opportunity to conduct the final interview with him and then hid upstairs in his house filming as the police came and took him away and took him to prison. And that three-month sentence ended up getting extended to 2 years, because while he was in prison, the other charges that were against him, those sentences came in. So he ended up being in prison for 2 years, all because of freedom of expression and, you know, exercising what should be the international right of freedom of expression and freedom for peaceable assembly. He got out of prison just this past June and was then detained again in October, briefly for a few weeks, then was released, and then was arrested again just last month on April 1st or April 2nd, and right now remains in prison. And again, it was because of, I believe, the official charge. I believe it was the cybercrime unit that arrested him. And the official charge was spreading false information on Twitter. So Bahrain is a country where your tweets can land you 2 years in prison. Nabil faces a possibility of an up to 10-year prison sentence right now with the different charges that are leveled against him. And they're all charges that are based on him practicing his right to freedom of expression and freedom of peaceable assembly.
And yet, truth in tweets didn't seem to affect. Was it the government that sent out a tweet that involved you?
It was not. It was not officially the government, but there are a series of trolls basically that are all aligned with the government, and it's very clear that they're, you know, that they are supported by what exactly. The details of exactly how the relationships between these trolls and the government works is a bit murky, but it's very clearly connected. And that's how we learned that the government was fully aware that I was in Bahrain and fully aware of what I was doing is they started sending out some tweets that involved me. And when we saw those tweets, the woman who I was profiling, who we were traveling around together, you know, she and I began to see those tweets and realized that, you know, my cover had been blown. They knew I was here. And at that point, we realized we might, you know, we might only have a matter of time. We never, you know, we never knew. At night, you'd hear helicopters overhead and you never knew if they were going to be whose house they were raiding. Was it going to be the house where I was staying? Was I able to get all my footage uploaded before they would come and raid that house to arrest me? Because, of course, I had sensitive interviews with people that I needed to get uploaded and out of the country. So every day we would go around filming and every night would be feeling like it was a race against the clock to get all the footage uploaded and then wiped off of, you know, off of the drive so that we weren't putting other people at risk.
So just over 5 minutes left. So talk about the uprising, how it is a nonviolent uprising. My impression is that women play a significant, if not the leading part in the uprising. And then if you could also talk about the U.S. role in all of this.
In 5 minutes.
Yes.
yeah, that's hard, you first. But we will try. Generally speaking, the this particular uprising, what happened in Bahrain, was seen by everybody, actually, generally as a nonviolent uprising. People were basically organizing themselves, bringing new tactics, basically, to raise their messages by just being very peaceful, using the methods that, I mean, many of the protesters in many of the Arab countries actually used. And the presence of women, the presence of old men in these protests, the kids, shows that. It's not surprising to see these images of popular protests, huge line of protesters, actually at some point hundreds of thousands of people protesting. And by the way, we are talking about a tiny country. When you see hundreds of thousands of people outside demanding something, just marching, that's actually quite powerful. In fact, many people know that this was actually the most popular uprising among the in the Arab countries. In fact, the majority of the population at many points went outside to demand this change. If it was a fraction of the population in Egypt or Syria or other countries, it was actually the majority of the population. And there were so many powerful images of activists practicing peaceful and nonviolent tactics, basically, on the ground. I remember now powerful images of a human rights activist. Her name is Zainab Al-Khwaja. She was at some point just sitting in a location in northern Bahrain, and she was forced. She was actually dragged by the police to remove her from her location, and she was standing on that particular location just peacefully. And the images were so powerful; they went viral. Obviously, they were published by all the media, and it shows because you know she's a woman and she's just sitting there, and she is basically being dragged by the government or by the police officers. And the power of these images shows how much you know people are really determined to raise their voices, even though with all this repression. Unfortunately, even though we know and believe that the United States, for example, as an ally to Bahrain, knows that for a fact, knows that this is a popular uprising and it represents the majority of the population and it is a peaceful movement. Unfortunately, the role was not as supportive as we have expected as Bahrainis. We always look at the United States as a country that is the values of democracy and human rights is in the heart of this particular nation, and the experience for this nation to rise as an international power is basically as it's rooted in these values, and which is why when we see their reaction towards what is happening in our country, we are actually disappointed. With all the statements that always mentions that Bahrain, the Bahraini government is an ally to the United States, but there are human rights violations that have been committed here and there. But then again, there are no actual actions to support the change, to support the people and their demands. We do understand. I mean, it's kind of very clear that the U.S. Fifth Fleet Navy is stationed in Bahrain. This is a major factor that plays a part in why the U.S. is not actually supporting any change. We do realize that Saudi Arabia, which is our neighbor, which made it very clear that Bahrain is kind of their territory, is a very important ally to the United States, and this is why it will be very hard to support a democratic Bahrain in this environment. But again, I think the Bahraini citizens are looking for the United States to stand by their values, the values that they have always tried to share and support around the world. And we didn't see that in Bahrain. Jenny, you want to add something?
Well, I wanted to make sure the point about the U.S. Navy Fifth Fleet being based in Bahrain got mentioned, and then you mentioned that. But I would say that we as U.S. citizens also have a role here. I mean, our government is set up, at least in theory, that we're able to let our concerns known to our representatives, and the U.S. government, who does back up the regime of Bahrain, we can let our representatives know that we expect our government to hold the Bahraini government accountable for their human rights violations and to implement true reforms. I suggest for folks who want more information, they should definitely go to the film's website, which is witnessbahrain.com. If folks want to take action on behalf of Nabil Rajab, they can go to bahrainrights.org. There is currently a petition right now that the Bahrain Center for Human Rights is circulating to try to press for Nabil's release. And I think there's lots of ways that we in this country are responsible for what's happening in Bahrain. So therefore, a lot of responsibility on us as citizens to make our voices heard about this.
All right. And are there going to be any other showings of Witness Bahrain?
The next showing that's going to be in Seattle is going to be, and I don't have the details of this quite yet, but it's going to be at Seattle's Arab Fest at the end of August.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you both for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks.